You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on this week's edition of Snap Judgment. This week's stories about what we do when we want to be alone. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, we continue our ongoing series on issues that have come up on the presidential campaign trail.
In their convention acceptance speeches, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton both tackled issues of crime, justice, and safety. Donald Trump made the case that crime has emerged as a major threat and that as the law and order candidate, he would turn things around.
I have a message for all of you. The crime and violence that today afflicts our nation will soon, and I mean very soon, come to an end.
In her address, Hillary Clinton didn't share Trump's focus on crime as something that was out of control, but she called for reforms in the aftermath of police shootings and of this summer's high-profile shootings targeting police in Dallas and Baton Rouge.
We will reform our criminal justice system from end to end and rebuild trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve.
Our next guest joins for a look at crime in the United States, the long-term trends, and the available policy options for a new president and Congress.
Stan Stojkovic is a professor of criminal justice and dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. Stan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start with a really big picture, looking at a violent crime in the United States over the long haul. What have the trends looked like up until last year?
Well, what we really see is a decrease in violent crime, a significant decrease, particularly during the 90s and the turn of the century. If you go all the way back to 1960, you're talking over 50 years of data that we have. If you start comparing and looking at, you see a slow increase in violent crime. But when you start to see a massive decrease in the 90s and a continued decrease during the beginning part of this century and a slight uptick. Now, I'm looking at Wisconsin data specifically. There is variation across the country, but the general theme is that violent crime has actually gone down.
Well, Donald Trump points toward a recent jump in crime in some places anyway. And let's give a listen. Again, this is his acceptance speech.
These are the facts. Decades of progress made in bringing down crime are now being reversed by this administration's rollback of criminal enforcement. Homicides last year increased by 17% in America's 50 largest cities. That's the largest increase in 25 years.
Well, Stan, we've talked to you about that increase and the numbers in Milwaukee in particular last year. That the data is correct as far as it goes. Is he on the right track saying we're erasing the progress of the last 25 years in this uptick in major cities last year?
No, not actually. I mean, what we've seen is, particularly as it relates to violent crime, murder, non-negligent homicide, or manslaughter, excuse me, those rates stay fairly consistent. There are slight ticks back and forth, but we have to distinguish between rates and indices. So you could have an indice measure that's simply a raw frequency count. How many did you have last year? That's different than a rate because we expect populations, a rate controls for populations, so it's oftentimes recognized as per 100,000 or per 10,000. And that controls for population and allows you to get a more smooth understanding about, did crime actually go up in a particular category or did it go down? Where you start to see problems of interpretation, and I think Mr. Trump has some of these problems, is the massive aggregation effect or trying to look at crime as, violent crime. Well, what violent crime? What are you talking about? A vast majority of violent crime is in the aggravated assault category. That by far overreaches even murder, forcible rape, robbery. Those are all considered violent crimes. Aggravated assault makes up a vast majority of that violent crime. Now, those are serious crimes. I don't want to minimize that, but I think to suggest that there's a rollback or that individuals are, being treated differently, I think that would be an incorrect statement.
With homicide numbers, we did see increases. Milwaukee, we were tracking the numbers, the sad numbers last year. Other cities, Baltimore, Donald Trump talked about a few moments after that clip we just played, other cities. We did see a jump in homicide last year relative to the low numbers in other recent years, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. And in fact, you know, I don't know how much of that is a statistical artifact. We tend to find bodies when homicides, so they're fairly good, and we tend to arrest people for these homicides. But still, in the larger context, homicide is a very rare occurrence relative to other types of crimes. Homicides don't even come close to aggravated assaults in terms of incidence or prevalence. So we don't want to minimize the importance. Every person that gets killed through a homicide, that's an important event, but what we do want to understand is context. And these contexts oftentimes change, but there is some sense of smoothing out of the data, so to speak, if you take longer periods looking at it. For example, if you look at murder and non-negligent homicide, or manslaughter, excuse me, uniform crime reports, which are the official measures of crime in America, indicate relative stability and then a drop, a significant drop, particularly in the 90s. And right now, for example, the 2012 data indicates that, you know, three homicides, non-negligent manslaughters per 100,000 people in the state of Wisconsin. Well, that's analogous to what we had in 1974. So that's 40 years, over 40 years.
So huge question, Stan. What do you know about why these homicide trends and violent crime trends went down so much from the 80s to the recent years?
Well, there's a lot of interpretation on that and a lot of debate, everything from allowing abortions. In other words, the theory there an economist put forward is that with the abortion move, a lot of these people who were born in poverty, who may wind up being either killed or be killers, they were aborted. And as a result, the rates went down. In fact, one economist says this is a big variable. Most criminologists don't buy that argument. Instead, what they tend to buy is the idea that better systems of crime control, better policing, and including increased incarceration, that putting people in prison. The question is, how many people do you put in for a marginal return that allows you to say it's worth it? And that's a, you know, public policy discussion. But there are a lot of theories associated with it. The most recent theory is that a lot of these drops can be explained relative to just better ways to protect ourselves, better target hardening, better approaches. I mean, for example, if you look at burglary rates, they have dropped precipitously, largely due to better ways of protecting ourselves against burglars that we didn't have, let's say, 40, 50 years ago. So that's gaining some ascendancy among criminologists. Just, you know, target hardening, excuse me, and better approaches to dealing with crime.
Talking to Stan Stojkovic from UW-Milwaukee, looking at crime in the United States, long-term trends. It's an issue that's come up in the presidential race, coming from both campaigns. We talked a little bit about what Donald Trump had to say. Here's a little bit from Hillary Clinton. This is, again, in her acceptance speech, drawing attention to the issue of guns and gun control in crime.
We will work tirelessly with responsible gun owners to pass common sense reforms and keep guns out of the hands of criminals, terrorists, and all others who would do us harm. You know, for decades, people have said this issue was too hard to solve and the politics too hot to touch. But I ask you, how can we just stand by and do nothing?
So, Stan, speaking of issues with lots of theories on how things work out, what do we know, if anything, about the impact of the availability of guns and either leading to more violent crime, as some say, or acting as a deterrent to violent crime, as others say?
Well, the evidence on this is ambiguous and, as you can imagine, all over the place, depending upon how you define it and how you measure it. And that may sound like a trite and or simplistic response, but it really is important. For example, carry concealed laws that have been around for decades. I mean, Wisconsin jumped on this bandwagon relatively late compared to other states. Its premise is that there will be a deterrent effect, that individuals carrying these weapons legally, registered, so to speak, will offer a deterrent. The bad guy's not going to know if you have a gun, if you want to rob him, so to speak, or rob you, so to speak. And so it falls apart when you start to look at the numbers of people who actually have the permits. It's only about 4 to 6% of the adult population actually seeks a permit, those that are eligible, that don't have felony convictions, I mean. I mean, the fact of the matter is your deterrence argument goes right out the window because there aren't enough people to have the guns. Why? Because most people understand, listen, I don't need a gun in my social life. Some people might, but I don't. And as a result, I make these decisions. But the gun relationship is way beyond, I think, a lot of empirical analysis. You have to look at it in the context of how many guns are actually out there, both legal and illegal. And there are millions, literally hundreds of millions of guns. Any attempt, even if you were a you know, pro-gun control person, you're not going to be able to have the impact because the numbers are just purely staggering. We're a gun culture, and we always have been a gun culture, and that may be part of our, you know, political process and our political understanding of a relationship of an individual to its government, and that's what a lot of people who are pro-gun people tend to put forward that argument, at least one of their arguments. But the fact of the matter is there is no clear and convincing evidence that doing something now would necessarily lead toward a reduction. That would be very difficult to know.
Hillary Clinton has said she wants some what she calls common sense gun reform. She says she's not out to confiscate guns or repeal the Second Amendment. But is there such a thing as a common sense gun reform, maybe that a state has tried, that actually makes a difference in reducing violence?
Well, again, it would be very difficult to what does that mean when you say common sense? How do you operationalize that? For example, do you want people to carry semi-automatic weapons or automatic weapons? Do you want to give people that, the gun shows and the people where they can sort of, not necessarily skirt rules, but it's easier to get around rules and laws at these areas. You know, what about that? How do you make that happen? It's real difficult to offer a linear answer to that question. Do things intuitively make sense? You know, if you, maybe they do. What do you need an automatic weapon for, right? And most people who are reasonable and rational about that say, you don't need that weapon. That weapon provides nothing for you in terms of protection. It can only be used for killing people. It can't be used for sport in most cases. It can't be used for, you know, target shooting. So that discussion has to occur. But, you know, this is more a political discussion, and clearly it's being one, than an empirical discussion. And I think individuals have to sit back and say, what do we really want to put out there, given our history and the kinds of constraints that we've placed because of our history?
We're talking about crime trends in the United States with Stan Stojkovic from UW-Milwaukee, looking at violent crime, safety, and criminal justice reform as they've been big issues in the presidential race.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are these issues that you vote on, that you worry about? Are there candidates' policies on crime and criminal justice that are important decision makers for you? And what policies would you like to see changed or continued or expanded when it comes to crime and safety in the United States? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We're continuing our conversation with Stan Stojkovic, criminal justice professor at UW-Milwaukee. And we're looking at crime and criminal justice in the United States, with both major party presidential candidates making it an issue in the election campaign.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about violent crime? Is that something that sways your vote? Are you looking for changes in the way we police our communities and the way our prison system works? What could the next president do to improve things? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller now with Scott on the line in Eau Claire. Scott, hi.
Hi, yes. I guess I was wondering how the crime is actually developed in your, like, ratio of, is it due to unemployment rates that we see an increase, or where are the crimes coming from? Are these people actually unemployed that are creating a lot of these crimes? Is it to do with other issues with, I'm not really sure where the crimes are coming from. That's my question.
All right. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. So, Stan, this, I think, is an eternal question. Is there a link between economic downturns and rising crime rates?
Well, there is a relationship, but that, too, sometimes is spurious or doubtful. I think it would be a mistake, given the general understanding of the relationship between, you know, economic opportunity and crime. There clearly is a relationship, but it's not as linear as people might think. What's probably more important around the person's question is, I mean, who's committing a crime? What crime should we be concerned about? Obviously, violent crime seems to get most of the attention. But when you start to look at property crime, and the FBI has a property crime index and a violent crime index, you start to look at these official measures of crime. You know, the two most common crimes in America are larceny theft, which is reflected through shoplifting, and drunk driving. And if you're looking at crime and you say, oh, all right, I want to break that down, who's committing these crimes? What kind of crimes are they committing? Those two are the big the big winners, so to speak. They explain, depending upon where you're located, anywhere between 70% to 90% of all crime in America are just two crimes. And so you start to understand it that way, and you start to say, well, wait a minute, can we develop policies to address those issues? Shoplifting cuts across all socioeconomic groups, all racial groups, suburban, urban. It's a huge issue for businesses, particularly new businesses, as is drunk driving. Drunk driving, and in the state of Wisconsin, this is a huge issue. So if you're talking about crime generically and you want to break it down, you got to look at those crimes, but clearly the ones that get the most attention are the violent crimes. But they are the least common when you're talking about crime.
Thanks for the call. We'll go back to our callers now with Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Yes, I just want to hi. Good day. I just want to make one comment and get your guest's response. The one common empirical factor that was relevant to the police victims in Dallas and Baton Rouge, the children in Sandy Hook, the people in the nightclub in Orlando, the moviegoers in Colorado, Congressman Gifford's harm, all of them had one thing in common. They were all shot with an AR-15, mm-hmm. which is a fully automatic weapon. And I understand that homicide is a subset, and mass shootings are a subset of that subset. But regardless, isn't this one area we could call or address the common sense gun control? I'll take my answer off the air.
Jim, thanks for that call. As I understand, the AR-15s in question were not modified to fire automatically. They were semi-automatic, but with large ammunition capacity, Stan. But your thought on this one particular weapon?
Well, I think the caller makes a really good point. You have to have a point of departure during this discussion and debate, and I think that's a good one. I think you're hard-pressed as a typical, you know, a citizen in America to justify either an automatic or a semi-automatic weapon, as I said earlier. So I think that as a point of departure for that discussion and debate, this is a great start. There is some commonality across these mass shootings. Even though we've seen a real, you know, spate of mass shootings, particularly in the last year, in the long term, they are relatively rare events. But, you know, when they happen, they really impress upon the consciousness of people in America, and political leaders have to respond as they should. The question is, what's the appropriate response, and how do we define the problem? So I would agree with the caller. We don't, you know, we may not have to go much further than really starting with that discussion about automatic and or semi-automatic weapons.
Jim, thanks for that call. Given the rarity of mass shootings, and as you said, violent crime compared to other crimes in particular, also reasonably rare, Stan, does it make it hard to craft policy around these exceptional events?
Yes, it does, because, you know, policy is meant for the general, not the specific. And we have a saying in criminology, you know, that the horror stories, the aberrant events, are horrible policy. You know, for policy perspective, because what happens is you're defining something as normative that really isn't the norm. And you try to go after it. But, you know, the worst thing that can happen in political life is that you're defined as irrelevant. And so what you have to do is define something and provide some opportunity. But I think that the politician's role is to provide informed debate about issues of crime. When people talk to me about crime, I'm sort of biased because I know a lot about it. Crime is a nebulous, meaningless, ambiguous concept unless you operationalize it with greater specificity. So the next question is, what type of crime are you talking about? Because it's a ubiquitous term. So I would always say to people, if you want to get legislators really moving on this, you have to be more precise, but you must recognize the difficult nature of operationalizing a term, measuring it, and then ultimately holding people accountable to whatever you provide.
Talking to criminal justice professor Stan Stojkovic at UW-Milwaukee about crime and crime trends in the United States, an issue in the presidential election race. We'll go back to our callers with Jared in Green Bay. Jared, hi.
Hey, thanks. My comment is I wonder how much, like, you know, with the heavy emphasis on, like, crime and violence and mass shootings, just violent crime in general in the media, thanks to our 24-hour news cycle, how much of that, you know, makes the situation worse than it would be otherwise? I feel like we've reached a point here where there's, like, a tiny little wound, but the inflammation around it is so huge that it's a bigger problem than the actual, you know, wound itself. Like, Milwaukee, I mean, I don't want to get into that entire issue of, you know, Milwaukee stuff, but a lot of that rioting and problem seems to be mostly to do with people being convinced that the cops are at war with them, when that's partially to do with just that's what they've been told on the ground. it's a lot more complicated than that.
Jared, thanks for the call. So, Stan, media perception, a crime now that happens in Florida 30 years ago was a local news story there. Now it might be a national news story. We're constantly seeing the crime story. Is that changing what we think about how common crime, violent crime are?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that this 24-hour news barrage, the problem with 24-hour news barrage is oftentimes you don't have the right questions. Not so much the right facts. You're asking the wrong questions. Hence, you're not getting the right answers either. You're misdirected in terms of that effort. But there's a whole slew of academic research that examines the relationship between media and ultimately crime policy. How are politicians influenced by media kinds of portrayals? And this oftentimes leads to bad public policy in the long run. Because, again, the rare event should not be the normative event and should not define it. But today, technology does play a role in giving people access to information in a moment, in a heartbeat. The problem is that oftentimes concision and short reports are the enemy of the truth.
Very briefly, Stan, just a few seconds. Can a president really make a difference in the policies that he or she implements?
No, not really. The fact of the matter is crime is a local phenomenon. It's controlled locally. It's largely budgeted locally, except for some federal outlays for specific programs. So the reality is that local communities have to respond to these things in the way that they can best respond. It won't be through the federal government or through a presidential candidate.
Stan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely.
That's Stan Stojkovich. He's professor of criminal justice and dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee, looking at crime and crime trends in the United States in light of the presidential election race. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.